So we continue this morning with the What Now series, and I am excited, I'm ecstatic to speak to you this morning about the Apostle Peter. Simon Peter, the Apostle Peter, as he's more widely known. We're going to be taking a look at his life, we're going to be taking a look at his relationship with Jesus, his denial of Jesus, his subsequent redemption and reconciliation through Jesus. We're going to look at Peter's What Now moment and highlight what very well may be his most courageous act. And we're going to take this sermon and we're going to break it up into two parts. There's going to be pre-resurrection and post-resurrection. And no, that doesn't mean that I'm going to be speaking for 2 weeks. You're like, no, it just means that this sermon is going to have two sections, a pre and a post. And so you'll know when I switch. Let's jump right in. So Peter was a fisherman, right? But he's not like, in my mind, I always think like Deadliest Catch kind of gruff kind of fisherman. It's like a beard like Nick, you know, like that. But not really. Like, they think of them as a fisherman by necessity. Like, that's kind of what they had to do to survive. So he's not any bigger or you know, any bigger than any normal guy. Just think of him as a normal, everyday, average guy. And keep that in your mind as we walk through some of the things that he said and he did within his life. See, Peter's life really starts the moment he encounters Jesus. Why? Because that's what we have recorded. We don't know about his life before. But I can tell you about his life before because it was about a struggle of survival. They needed to survive, and everybody understood that, some more than others. So that's what before, and then he encounters in Jesus in Matthew chapter 4, verses 18 to 20. While walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." Immediately, they left their nets and followed him. There wasn't a moment of thought, which you can see is par for the course in the life of Peter. He doesn't think about it. He chooses to follow Jesus and then dives headfirst into a relationship with him. But see, when Jesus tells Peter that I will make you a fisher of men, I will make you fishers of men, what he's saying is I'm going to alter the course of your destiny, but I'm going to take these tools, these skills that you've been given, and I'm going to put them to a greater purpose than you could ever think of on your own, greater than the purpose of man. I'm actually going to set you on a path so you're using those skills for the reason that I gave them to you. Which is pretty amazing. A purpose that is more than just survival, but it's life, and it's life abundantly through knowing Jesus. See, Jesus was awesome like that. He used analogies that people could really sink their teeth into. And when he walked up to Peter and said, "I will make you a fisher of men," it's something that Peter could connect with. And he's like, okay, he accepted that invitation. And when Jesus changed his name, he did more than just that. He changed his eternity. Like, the destination of where he was going was forever changed within that moment. And that's pretty amazing. You see, Peter was one of the first two disciples called. And this is just speculation. Wild speculation on my part. But it's funny. But I can see when the disciples started growing, like, Peter looking at Jesus, like, you remember when it was just us? Like, me, you, and Andrew, like, the fishers of men, us three, right? Like, yeah. And then, you know, they get into the upper room and they're arguing about who's going to be the greatest. And I can see Peter looking at Jesus like, remember? Remember when you called me fishers of men, like it was us three? But if you read through the New Testament, you're going to understand pretty quickly that Peter loved Jesus. Like, he really cared for his friend. Theirs was one of their relationship was teacher and student, but also friends. Peter's love for Jesus shown in so many different ways. Like the first time when he publicly tells everyone who Jesus actually is. So we're in Matthew 16 and Jesus is talking to the disciples and asking them, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answer back, "Well, John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, the prophets." He's like, "Hold on, who do you say that I am?" And Peter steps forward and says, "Oh, hold on, I got this. You are the Messiah. You are the Son of the living God." This was the first time they had openly confessed this. This was the first time that anyone really had openly or publicly confessed Jesus as the Son of God. But we see Peter throughout the Gospels as a man conflicted. One moment brave, yes, and another moment a fearful coward. And we see it displayed with regularity through his life. I think one of the best displays of this we find in Matthew when Peter looks out from the boat and sees Jesus walking on the water, right? We know this story well. Peter calls him and says, "Jesus, Lord, call to me and I'll come to you." And he's like, "Come on then." And Peter's like, "Get me out of this boat. Woo!" Okay, there's no thought. It's not like Peter pondered what it would be like to walk on the water. No, Peter got out of the boat and began walking, a very courageous act, but one that he did not think about. And then he sat down and started, or didn't sit down, he looked down at his feet. He started sinking. What did he scream? Do you remember what he screamed? "Lord, save me!" Peter knew how to swim. Okay? He wasn't going to drown. And we'll see that he knows how to swim here in a minute. He wasn't going to drown. Was he afraid of getting his tunic wet? Like, what was the real reason? No, he stepped out as a courageous man, not thinking about what that step of faith actually meant. And then when he got into it, he got fearful and he became a coward and said, "Oh my goodness, save me. There's water there. Save me, Lord." I think many of us can make comparisons between the life of Peter and the life of our own. We say something, yes, and then when we actually get out and have to walk, we're like, wait a minute, that water doesn't seem like it's going to hold me. I'm not sure I should actually do that. We need to think about, as we're looking at the life of Peter, we need to think about Peter as someone who loves fiercely, but is also frightened of what that could mean and what sacrifices he could be called to make because of that love if he sat down and thought about it for a moment. See, but he's not really a thinker in that regard. He's a doer. So he doesn't sit down and think about those things. Peter made some bold claims within his life with no thought to what those claims actually meant. He's just shooting from the hip. And probably none more bold than what we find him saying in John 13. And it says this: Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, Lord, where are you going?" And Jesus answered, "Where I'm going, you cannot follow, but you will afterwards." Peter said to him, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay my life down for you." And Jesus answered, "Will you lay your life down for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, the rooster will not crow until you have denied me three times." Oof, ouch. You see, Peter makes this insanely bold statement to Jesus: "I will die for you." Jesus goes, "Hold on. No, you won't. You see, you think you will. This is my own thing." This is called getting smacked by Jesus. What? Wait. I said I would die for you. No, actually, what you will do is the exact opposite. That when you get to that moment, instead of laying your life down for me, you will cling to it. And you will choose to save it and abandon me. And this is what he's telling him here. That the brave Peter, the courageous Peter, in that moment, within that moment, he would be a coward. Now, I want to stay on this just for a second so we can understand of the scope of emotions probably welling within Peter. Now, we have to understand that he loved Jesus. This was someone that he loved very much. And his Lord just told him, "Hey, instead of actually laying down your life, you're going to deny me." But the most amazing part about this, the craziest part, is there's no more communication from them, between them, until afterwards. So, I want you to remember this, though, and I want you to keep it in your mind, because this is the biggest failure of Peter's life. And I want you to remember it, because we're going to come back to it. So Peter makes this bold claim, right? And then a young girl's questions, "Hey, weren't you that guy that was with Jesus?" make him abandon everything that he had been working 3 years with Jesus and say, "I don't know. I don't know that guy. I don't know him." This was out of doubt the low point of Peter's life. He denied his friend and he left him to die, and that's exactly what happened to him. He was tortured, humiliated, beaten, and then murdered. My thought goes to, where is Peter at the crucifixion site? Like, where is he? There's no mention of him. There's no mention of where he is, what he could be doing. But this is when we switch. Post-resurrection, we find him back with the disciples. How? Why? When? These are questions I don't have the answers to. There's only speculation. But here's my deal with this, is you don't need to know the answers why. You don't need to know why. What you need to know is his path of restoration and reconciliation, which Jesus starts in Mark 16. And it says this: "And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe. And they were alarmed and said to them, 'Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him, but go. Tell the disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you.'" Why does he mention Peter by name? You see, because Peter had denied Jesus before men. Peter was around when Jesus was talking about that. "You deny me before men, and I deny you before the Father." And so he probably was going, ugh. The enemies of Jesus had confronted Peter with the fact that he was one of his followers, and he said, "No, I'm not." But see, now came amazing news. Now came amazing news in the fact that Jesus was risen, that his Lord is risen. He is resurrected. He actually did it. And through an angel, he made a special request to see Peter. Now, what did this mean for Peter? It means that Jesus still counted him as one of the disciples. It means that Jesus had not disowned him or abandoned him as Peter did. It means that Peter could still look at Jesus and say, I belong to you. I'm still yours. Within our life and our walk with God, we're going to have some moments of sheer horror as we think about some of the choices and decisions we've made that have led us to the places that we are. Now, whether that place is in the past and you think about, wow, I can't believe I was there, whether you are there right now or whether you see the lights coming down the track and the choices that you're making are leading you there, those places that we're going are far from Jesus and back into what we did before typically. Why? Because when we get scared, we kind of back up and we kind of go back into what we were doing. Our old ways of thinking, our old thought patterns. And Peter was he was not immune to that. Not at all. So in John 21, we see a resurrected Jesus, incognito, standing on the shore of the Sea of Tiberias. That means no one knows who he is. And he's calling out to the disciples, hey, you guys got any fish? They're like, no. Throw your net on the right side. See what happens. So they throw their net on the right side and they're like, oh my goodness, so much fish, we can't even pull it in. And then one of the disciples is like, that's Jesus. And again, Peter, not thinking, throws off his tunic, and this is how we know he can swim. Woo! Right into the water. Swims to the shore to see Jesus. Now there's a lot of amazing things that can be said about this exchange, but I think what is the most puzzling and the most skipped, to be honest, is what were they doing in the boat? Now you could be like, well, they were necessity and they were trying to eat. Yeah. No. It was out of comfort and fear that they were there with a giant net trying to go back to what they knew. Their Lord, he was gone. So out of fear and out of comfort, they went back to their old ways. And I resonate with that because sometimes when I'm scared, sometimes when I'm nervous, I find myself wanting to go back to an old pattern, an old way of thinking. Instead of moving forward and trusting and moving forward in faith. Now, by now, all of you should know that I like to control situations. And sometimes that's a good thing. Not really, but sometimes that's a good thing for me. And sometimes it's not a good thing. But I get in these modes, right, where I begin to release control. And it's very freeing. It's scary, but it's very freeing. And I release control of areas of my life to God, and it's wonderful. And then I release control of areas of my job to qualified people, and it's amazing. And then I start to get nervous. And then I start to get fearful. And I begin to grab back those pieces. And I say things like, it's not that I don't trust you. It's just that I like to do it this way. But I mean, let's get real. I need to have more faith. This is something that I'm dealing with. But I think we deal with this as Christians far more than we think we do. Because when we get fearful, when we get scared, when we get nervous or anxious, we tend to fall back into a comfortable old pattern of doing things. Because your life with Jesus should never be comfortable. It shouldn't. I'm sorry if you think that. But it shouldn't be. This is all too common scenario in many of our lives, as well as Peter. Because, see, Jesus has other ideas for Peter. He has other ideas, and he wants to know a simple question, and he asks it three times. And it's very fitting, because that's the exact number of times that Peter denied him. But he says in John 21, he says, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus had said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, feed my lambs. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he had said to him a third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. So he asks him this question over and over and over. And Peter responds to it. And he says, feed my sheep. Tend to my people. Be their shepherd. This was the ultimate reinstatement of Peter. This was forgiveness and restoration at its highest degree. Listen to me. This is why Jesus died. This right here. To forgive and to restore. And we see it played out amazingly in the life of the Apostle Peter. This exchange was not only symbolic in the fact that it represented Peter's restoration, but also it symbolized the fact that there was still more work to be done. See, Jesus on the cross and resurrection wasn't the end, but it was the beginning to take that love and to cover the entire world with it. I mean, think about that for a second. You go from unbelievable sorrow to unimaginable joy in seeing that. But Jesus didn't come back to give people joy. He came back with a purpose. Every moment has a purpose, and he came back with a purpose. Now, I can tell you today what God is calling you to do. And you're like, what? Are you a prophet? Nope. Throw that right out of there. But I can tell you what God is calling you to do today. He's calling you to know him and make him known, and we've been talking about that. But what I can't tell you is how that's going to manifest in your life, see, because you've been given special talents and gifts, and God has things that he wants you to do, that he planned for you to do long before you ever set foot on this earth. You're special, and maybe those things only you can do, and that should excite you, but that can also make you nervous. And within that nervousness, you can feel that it's right to maybe take a step back. But I can tell you honestly today, and 100% truth, that Jesus never, ever wants you to take a step back in your relationship with him at all. See, we've become comfortable. We've become comfortable sitting and watching. We've become comfortable watching people get hurt. We've become comfortable watching other people's lives and envying what they have that we don't. We've become comfortable watching other people's despair and thanking God that it's not us. And we watch, and we watch, and we watch. And this type of thinking, this type of mentality is wrong. But see, it's easy to get into and hard to get out of, because when our mind patterns us in things, it begins to feel right. And so you sit there, and you watch, and you watch, and you watch, and it feels right to you. But your mind is deceiving you. There must be action in our walk with God. Absolutely must be action in our walk with God. And that doesn't mean that you're on a spiritual treadmill. And let me just say this. Let me just say this, and maybe I won't have to say this every single time I say this. I cannot stand the fact that every time I talk to you, anybody, about doing something for God, that I have to throw this caveat in that we are not a works-based religion. I hope that you understand that we're not a works-based religion, that Jesus has done it all of it. However, there is a however. That your saving faith within you, that faith that you have within you, should well up within you some sort of change in your life, whether that's your perceptions, your priorities, your passions, your speech, your actions, whatever that is, there will be some change that people can see outwardly. And so if you're walking around blending in with everyone else, check yourself, please. Ask yourself the hard questions. Do you have faith? Are you moving forward in faith? Because it's easy to say, yeah, yeah, yeah. But the Bible says, if you do, there will be evidence of it. Period. You cannot refute that. If you have faith, there will be evidence of it. It will translate in some outward form that people can see. So what now for Peter, right? He's been reinstated. He's been given purpose by God. By Jesus, this is what I need you to do. What does he do next? Acts 2:14, amazing. Then Peter stood up with the 11, raised his voice and addressed the crowd, fellow Jews and all who live in Jerusalem, let me explain this to you. Listen carefully to what I say. You think I'm going to go on, but I'm not. That's the end. What? Wait, are you serious? Yeah. This simple act says so much. But what was it? What in this verse did he do that was so mind-blowing? He stood up. He decided he had watched long enough. He decided to take action. He was not going to allow doubt to rule him. He made a decision to stand, and you understand that it changed everything for him. You look at the Apostle Peter before this, and you look at it after him, and you see a changed man. Before this in his life, he was reckless and prideful. And now we see a more muted version of that. We see courage and humility displayed within him. But this is what I love about Jesus, because Jesus told him what was going down. He told him what was going to happen in Luke 22. Listen to this. He says, reverting to Peter's original name, the Lord said, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat. But I've prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you've turned back, strengthen your brothers. I've prayed that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. Now, I'm like, am I reading this wrong? So I went and I studied that little passage just to make sure that I'm not telling you incorrectly. No, I'm telling you right. He's telling him, I'm praying that you're not going to fail, but you are. And when you do, you take that and you strengthen your brothers with your own failure. You take and you come back to them and you strengthen them through this. And that's exactly what he would do. See, Peter, he caught a glimpse of it. He was just too prideful to see it. But see, nothing that Peter would do is going to catch Jesus by surprise. And let me tell you this, that nothing that he did changed their relationship even in the slightest. Nothing he did. Peter's failure would humble him. It would make him a more compassionate leader. And those people who looked to him for that, his disciples, his friends, would look at him and see his failure, and it would make their own easier to bear. There is no human on this planet that is perfect. I know we've heard that, and we've said that, and we've probably said that a million times as we're looking at our own shortcomings. Well, there's no one on this planet that's perfect, but what does that mean to you? What do we do with that information? Knowing the life of the Apostle Peter and his relationship with Jesus, how does that or how should that change your perception on that phrase? And it should change it greatly. See, because Peter denied Jesus, Peter abandoned Jesus right to his face. His sin was laid bare for Jesus to see right in front of him. Just like you, just like me, same deal, same thing. See, we are Peter. We are sinners yet forgiven. We are once lost yet found. And we have been given a purpose greater than our own. See, Hebrews 12, 1-3 says this, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising its shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. Normally, pastors quote this passage, and they stop at verse 2. But I thought it very fitting to push it to verse 3 because it says, consider him. Consider him within this so that you do not grow weary and you do not become faint-hearted. I know there are those of you out there today that are weary and that are faint-hearted. You had that flame for Jesus burning bright and now it's down to a flicker. I'm begging you, consider Jesus within these moments. Consider him. Consider the fact that he took your sin and shame on that cross. But even more than that, consider the fact that you need to ask him for strength. Consider him and asking him to reignite that fire within you. Consider asking him to take you back to that place when you were in love with him and when nothing else but him mattered. And your life, you're just like, I'm just going to live it for you, God. Because he can take you back to that place if you consider him through it. He asks us to consider him. See, Peter was weary and faint-hearted when Jesus showed back up on the shore of the Sea of Tiberias, and he asked Peter to consider him, and he did it in the form of a question. Do you love me? And when Peter had considered him, he gave him a purpose. Now, like I said, I know what Jesus is calling you to do. Like, I know it. I just don't know how it's going to look in your life. But here's the deal. He does. So this morning, consider him and ask him what that looks like. You want a clearer picture? Ask somebody who's already has it painted to fill you in on what that might look like. The Apostle Peter took his step. And do you know what it was? It was to stand. He stood and addressed the crowd and said, I'm not going to let fear rule my life anymore. I'm not going to let doubt enslave me. I'm going to stand and I'm going to address the crowd. And he did so as a changed man. I can tell you this morning that Jesus is calling you to stand for him in your works, in your homes, in your schools, because people are watching you and they see who it is you live for. And they'll see if you're living for you, they'll know it. But if you're living for Jesus, if you're living for someone else, they're going to look and you're going to look differently. There's going to be some outward change within you that will make people sit up and take notice. Some of the strongest Christians and some of the strongest relationships with God that I know, I don't have to ask them. And neither do the people around them because they just know. So what does standing for Jesus mean to me? Now you could, I could leave you right now and just be like, let's pray it out. And you stand for Jesus. You'd walk outside and go, what's that mean? I'm going to go and get rid of all the chairs in my house. What does that really mean? Standing for Jesus means to me that I take my failures and my disappointments and I move past them. That I don't let the weight of those failures and disappointments hang around my neck like a millstone and drown me and suck away all the joy that Jesus has given me. Because it's very easy for me to do that. It means I look at the life of the Apostle Peter and I understand what forgiveness means. And I understand what it looks like. Because I can see it played out. It means that I take back my relationship with God. It means I take it back from all the outside and extenuating circumstances that try to dictate the time that I spend with my Lord. It means that I go, no, I'm going to make the priority and I'm going to set the schedule. It means that you consider him in everything that you do. Everything that you do. But listen to me, start small. You can go home and be like, I'm going to consider God in everything that I do from here on out. And you're going to fail. And then you're going to feel like a failure. I don't want to do this. And then you're going to have to start small. See, I was talking to a life group leader the other day and he said, I challenged my people this week to sit quiet before God, to be still before him for 5 minutes. And I'm like, whoo, that's going to be crazy. And he's like, can I challenge you to do the same? And I was like, oh, all right. But I did it. Okay, I'm really gonna commit to this. And I sat in my office, 5 minutes, quiet. I don't hear God audibly speak, sorry. But what I did feel was comforted. And I'm telling you what, that right now, that's what I need. I don't need God to speak to me audibly right now. I need to be comforted right now. And in that 5 minutes of me being still before him, I was. So I thought, if someone's challenging me, then of course, I love to challenge people, so I will take that and I will challenge. So we were here with our discipleship group of guys on Thursday night, and I challenged them to consider God for 1 hour on Saturday from 11 to 12. Now, I haven't talked to them. I don't know how it went, but I can tell you how my day went. When I woke up and come out to the bricks and I see paint spilled all over the place, I was not a happy dad. And then I was just, consider me, and I'm like, really, right now? There's paint, and I'm just... So I'm trying to consider God in this moment, and I am. And I could hear my wife going, everyone stay away from dad right now. Stay away from dad. Dad's a ticking time bomb. He will explode. Bah! But I just started to sit down and consider it. And God was like, you have kids. You have bricks for them to pour paint on. What are you really complaining about? And I was like, you know, and the wind's knocked out of you, and you're sitting there. Oh, and my kids come up to me, sorry, dad, we're so sorry. And I'm just like, man, what happened to me in that moment? And that was not the only thing. I mean, you know, I could go for an hour if you want me to. But within that hour, there were so many things that hit me. I was so much more thankful. I was so much more thankful than I ever would have been had I not been considering God in that moment within that time. So maybe that's what it means to you. Maybe your next step, your standing for God means that, hey, I'm just going to consider him for an hour and I'm going to start there and build and build and build upon that. Listen, I can tell you right now that if you're not in a life group, that you should get in one. You should begin to live life with those who are like-minded with you, to be refreshed during the week. If you're not doing that, you're cutting off one of your legs and saying, I'm going to run the race bleeding. Come on. Come on, let's be real. You need to be in one. You need to be in fellowship and community. If you're in a life group, take the next step. Walk to your leader and go, hey, what can we do as a life group? What can we do? Whether that's serving at a shelter, feeding the homeless, making blessing bags, cleaning the community, adopting a school, doing a backpack drive. Dude, you need something, come to me. You need something to do, come to me. We'll figure it out. But I want to do something. I want you to say this faith that's welling up within me is going to cause me to take some sort of action. That is your next step. There are tons and tons of avenues out there. Just like when Jesus left the disciples, he left them the entire world and was like, nobody knows about me yet. Go. go and tell everyone. And guess what? Those cloud of witnesses before you, those people that have gone before you, they took it seriously. Why? We are in Manteca, people. We are not in Jerusalem. We are in Manteca. And the love of Jesus made it all the way over here by their works. So now what? What are we going to do with it now? What do we do with it now that we have it? Do we take it like that man and hide it in a field? We know what happens to him. That's not what we do. We take it and say, I'm going to make a stand now in my relationship. I'm going to take the next step now. Because if you're not taking any steps, you know what you are? You're stagnant. You're not moving anywhere. Jesus is calling you to stand today. The question is, what is your response? Are you willing to stand? Let's pray.